What's wrong?
Nothing really. I just feel that I need something stronger.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will.
Rothschild.
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 How did Evelyn Rothschild become the filthy rich Grand Vizier to Queen Elizabeth II and godfather of the black nobility? By birth, Evelyn Rothschild is the great-great-great-grandson of Mayor Rothschild and is passing the godfathership down to David de Rothschild. Their story begins in 18th century Frankfurt, Germany, on a cobblestone street called Frankfurt on the Main. Mayor Amschel Bauer was a goldsmith and a loan shark. He hung a red hexagram shield over his doorway and changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, which means red shield in German. The red hexagram shield was the symbol for the World Revolutionary Movement. Family biographers describe Mayor Rothschild as a poor man who lived with his family above his goldsmith shop and sold rare coins to royal customers. Contrary to appearances, Mayor stashed a big supply of gold, precious coins, and jewels in special hiding places inside his house. One special hiding place was beneath the back courtyard, where he accessed his strongbox through an underground passageway. Mayor taught his five sons the tricks of the trade. To them, he wasn't just their father, he was their lord and master. To them, he was Lord Mayor.
In 1790, Amschel Rothschild made his pronouncement from his flagship bank in Frankfurt.
Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws. This is Frankfurt, Germany. 50 years after the Bank of England opened its doors, a goldsmith named Amschel Moses Bauer opened a coin shop, a counting house, in 1743. And over the door, he placed a sign depicting a Roman eagle on a red shield. The shop became known as the Red Shield Firm, or in German, Rothschild. When his son, Amschel Meyer Bauer, inherited the business, he decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayor Rothschild had five sons. He trained them all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Meyer, stayed in Frankfurt to mind the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Nathan, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England. His fourth son, Carl, went to Naples, and his fifth son, Jacob, went to Paris. In 1785, Mayor Amschel moved his entire family to this larger house, a five-story dwelling he shared with the Schiff family. This house was known as the Green Shield. The Rothschilds and the Schiffs would play a central role in the rest of European financial history and in that of the United States.
Mayor Rothschild's most successful sons, who ran the London Bank and who ran the Paris Bank, together they changed the face of history and became known throughout Europe as the Demon Brothers. With Rothschild financing, Adam Weishaupt formed a secret world revolutionary group called the Illuminati. He recruited thousands of influential members by convincing them that only men of superior ability had the right to rule over the ignorant masses. French police exposed the plan when they found documents on an Illuminati courier who was struck by lightning while traveling from Germany to France. The Illuminati was forced underground. They took refuge in the lodges of a secret brotherhood called the Freemasons.
Weishaupt had been active in the Masonic lodges of Germany and found in them the perfect vehicle for recruiting into his secret order, which he described publicly as the highest level of Freemasonry. The Illuminati was formally incorporated into the Masonic lodges at the Congress of Wilhelmsbach in 1780. It should be noted that Freemasonry in England and America, historically, is quite different. Its members are characterized by the highest standards of integrity. Nevertheless, it is a fact that from 1780 on, the Illuminati did flourish as a parasite on the highest levels of the Masonic movement in Europe, especially the Grand Orient Lodges of France.
Nathan and James Rothschild came up with a scheme that would put the Illuminati plan for world control into action. It would also make them filthy rich. The brothers helped finance both sides of Napoleon's famous Battle of Waterloo between the French and the English. With advanced knowledge of the British victory, Nathan Rothschild spread lies that the British had been defeated, which caused a stock market crash. While panicked English investors sold their life savings, Nathan bought up their market shares for pennies on the dollar. When official news of the British victory over Napoleon was announced, the English stock market skyrocketed, and so did Nathan's wealth.
The founding fathers knew the evils of a privately owned central bank. First of all, they had seen how the privately owned British central bank, the Bank of England, had run up the British national debt to such an extent that Parliament had been forced to place unfair taxes on the American colonies.
In fact, as we'll see later, Ben Franklin claimed that this was the real cause of the American Revolution. Most of the founding fathers realized the potential dangers of banking and feared bankers' accumulation of wealth and power. Jefferson put it this way:
I sincerely believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs.
That succinct statement of Jefferson is, in fact, the solution to all our economic problems today. It bears repeating. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. James Madison, the main author of the Constitution, agreed. Interestingly, he called those behind the central bank scheme money changers. Madison strongly criticized their actions.
History records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments by controlling money and its issuance.
Alexander Hamilton was a tool of the international bankers, and he wanted to create the U.S. Bank, the BUS, or the Bank of the United States, and did so.
Interestingly, one of Hamilton's first jobs after graduating from law school in 1782 was as an aide to Robert Morris, the head of the Bank of North America. In fact, the year before, Hamilton had written Morris a letter saying, "A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." A blessing to whom?
After a year of intense debate, in 1791, Congress passed the bill and gave it a 20-year charter. The new bank was to be called the First Bank of the United States, or BUS. Here we are in front of the First Bank of the United States in Philadelphia. The bank was given a monopoly on printing U.S. currency, even though 80% of its stock would be held by private investors. The other 20% would be purchased by the U.S. government,
But the reason was not to give the government a piece of the action. It was to provide the capital for the other 80% owners. As with the old Bank of North America and the Bank of England before that, the stockholders never paid the full amount for their shares. The U.S. government put up their initial $2 million in cash. Then the bank, through the old magic of fractional reserve lending, made loans to its charter investors so they could come up with the remaining $8 million of capital needed for this risk-free investment.
Like the Bank of England, the name of the Bank of the United States was deliberately chosen to hide the fact that it was privately controlled. And like the Bank of England, the names of the investors in the bank were never revealed. Many years later, it was a common saying that the Rothschilds were the power behind the old Bank of the United States.
The bank was sold to Congress as a way to bring stability to the banking system and eliminate inflation. So what happened? Over the first 5 years, the U.S. government borrowed $8.2 million from the Bank of the United States. In the same five-year period, prices rose by 72%. Jefferson, as the new Secretary of State, watched the borrowing with sadness and frustration, unable to stop it.
I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution, taking from the federal government the power of borrowing.
Millions of Americans feel the same way today. They watch in helpless frustration as the federal government borrows the American economy into oblivion. So, although it was called the First Bank of the United States, it was not the first attempt at a privately owned central bank in this country. As with the Bank of North America, the government put up most of the cash to get this private bank going, then the bankers loaned the money to each other to buy the remaining stock in the bank.
Towards the end of the Revolution, the Continental Congress, meeting here at Independence Hall, grew desperate for money. In 1781, they allowed Robert Morris, their financial superintendent, to open a privately owned central bank. Incidentally, Morris was a wealthy man who had grown wealthier during the Revolution by trading in war materials.
Called the Bank of North America, the new bank was closely modeled after the Bank of England. It was allowed to practice fractional reserve banking. That is, it could lend out money it didn't have, then charge interest on it. If you or I were to do that, we would be charged with fraud, a felony.
The bank's charter called for private investors to put up $400,000 worth of initial capital. But when Morris was unable to raise the money, he brazenly used his political influence to have gold deposited in the bank, which had been loaned to America by France.
He then loaned this money to himself and his friends to reinvest in shares of the bank. And, like the Bank of England, the bank was given a monopoly over the national currency. Soon the dangers became clear. The value of American currency continued to plummet. So, 4 years later, in 1785, the bank's charter was not renewed. The leader of the effort to kill the bank, William Findlay of Pennsylvania, explained the problem this way, quote, "This institution, having no principle but that of avarice, will never be varied in its object, to engross all the wealth, power, and influence of the state." The men behind the Bank of North America, Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris, and the bank's president, Thomas Wiling, did not give up. Only 6 years later, Hamilton, then Secretary of the Treasury, and his mentor, Morris, rammed a new privately owned central bank through the new Congress.
Called the First Bank of the United States, Thomas Wiling again served as the bank's president. The players were the same, only the name of the bank was changed.
In 1787, colonial leaders assembled in Philadelphia to replace the ailing Articles of Confederation. As we saw earlier, both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were unalterably opposed to a privately owned central bank. They had seen the problems caused by the Bank of England.
They wanted nothing of it. As Jefferson later put it,
if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations which grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
During the debate over the future monetary system, another one of the founding fathers, Gouverneur Morris, castigated the motivations of the owners of the Bank of North America.
Gouverneur Morris headed the committee that wrote the final draft of the Constitution. Morris knew the motivations of the bank well. Along with his old boss, Robert Morris, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton were the ones who had presented the original plan for the Bank of North America to the Continental Congress in the last year of the Revolution. In a letter he wrote to James Madison on July 2, 1787, Gouverneur Morris revealed what was really going on.
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will. They will have the same effect here as elsewhere if we do not, by the power of government, keep them in their proper spheres.
Despite the defection of Gouverneur Morris from the ranks of the bank, Hamilton, Robert Morris, Thomas Wiling, and their European backers were not about to give up. They convinced the bulk of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention to not give Congress the power to issue paper money. Most of the delegates were still reeling from the wild inflation of the paper currency during the Revolution. They had forgotten how well colonial scrip had worked before the war. But the Bank of England had not. The money changers could not stand to have America printing her own money again. So the Constitution is silent on the matter. This grievous defect left the door wide open for the money changers, just as they had planned.
In 1811, a bill was put before Congress to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States. The debate grew very heated, and the legislatures of both Pennsylvania and Virginia passed resolutions asking Congress to kill the bank.
The press corps of the day attacked the bank openly, calling it a great swindle, a vulture, a viper, and a cobra. Oh, to have an independent press once again in America.
A congressman named P.B. Porter attacked the bank from the floor of Congress, saying if the bank's charter was renewed, Congress, quote, will have planted in the bosom of this Constitution a viper, which one day or another will sting the liberties of this country to the heart, close quote.
Prospects didn't look that good for the bank. Some writers have even claimed that Nathan Rothschild warned that the United States would find itself involved in a most disastrous war if the bank's charter were not renewed.
But it wasn't enough. When the smoke had cleared, the renewal bill was defeated by a single vote in the House and was deadlocked in the Senate.
By now, America's fourth president, James Madison, was in the White House. Remember, Madison was a staunch opponent of the bank. His vice president, George Clinton, broke a tie in the Senate and sent the bank into oblivion.
Within 5 months, England attacked the U.S., and the War of 1812 was on. But the British were still busy fighting Napoleon, and so the War of 1812 ended in a draw in 1814. Though the money changers were temporarily down, they were far from out. It would take them only another 2 years to bring back their bank, bigger and stronger than ever.
Rothschild.
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 After 12 years of manipulations of the U.S. economy on the part of the Second Bank of the U.S., the American people had had just about enough. Opponents of the bank nominated a dignified senator from Tennessee, Andrew Jackson, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, to run for president. No one gave Jackson a chance initially. The bank had long ago learned how the political process could be controlled with money. To the surprise and dismay of the money changers, Jackson was swept into office in 1828. Jackson was determined to kill the bank at the first opportunity and wasted no time in trying to do so. During his first term, Jackson contented himself with rooting out the bank's many minions from government service. He fired 2,000 of the 11,000 employees of the federal government. In 1832, with his re-election approaching, the bank struck an early blow, hoping Jackson would not want to stir up controversy. They asked Congress to pass a renewal bill 4 years early. Naturally, Congress complied, then sent it to the president for signing. But Jackson weighed in with both feet. Old Hickory, never a coward, vetoed the bill. His veto message is one of the great American documents. It clearly lays out the responsibility of the American government towards its citizens, rich and poor.
It is not our own citizens only who are to receive the bounty of our government. More than 8 million of the stock of this bank are held by foreigners. Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that in its nature has so little to bind it to our country? Controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens in dependence would be more formidable and dangerous than a military power of the enemy. If government would confine itself to equal protection and, as heaven does its rains, shower its favor alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be a wide and unnecessary departure from these just principles.
Later that year, in July 1832, Congress was unable to override Jackson's veto. Now Jackson had to stand for re-election. Jackson took his argument directly to the people. For the first time in U.S. history, Jackson took his presidential campaign on the road. Before then, presidential candidates stayed at home and looked presidential. His campaign slogan was Jackson and no bank. Jackson was re-elected by a landslide in November of 1832. Despite his presidential victory, Jackson knew the battle was only beginning. The hydra of corruption is only scotched, not dead, said the newly elected president. Jackson ordered his new Secretary of Treasury, Lewis McLean, to start removing the government's deposits from the Second Bank and start placing them in state banks. But McLean refused to do so. Jackson fired him and appointed William J. DeWayne as the new Secretary of the Treasury. DeWayne also refused to comply with the president's requests, and so Jackson fired him as well and then appointed Roger B. Taney to the office. Taney did withdraw government funds from the bank starting on October 1st, 1833. Jackson was jubilant. I have it chained. I'm ready with screws to draw every tooth and then the stumps. But the bank was not yet done fighting. Its head, Nicholas Biddle, used his influence to get the Senate to reject Taney's nomination. Then, in a rare show of arrogance, Biddle threatened to cause a depression if the bank was not rechartered.
This worthy president thinks that because he has scalped Indians and imprisoned judges, he is to have his way with the bank. He is mistaken.
Next, in an unbelievable fit of honesty for a central banker, Biddle admitted that the bank was going to make money scarce to force Congress to restore the bank.
Nothing but widespread suffering will produce any effect on Congress. Our only safety is in pursuing a steady course of firm restriction. and I have no doubt that such a course will ultimately lead to restoration of the currency and the recharter of the bank.
What a stunning revelation. Here was the pure truth revealed with shocking clarity. Biddle intended to use the money contraction power of the bank to cause a massive depression until America gave in. Unfortunately, this has happened time and time again throughout U.S. history and is about to happen again in today's world. Nicholas Biddle made good on his threat. The bank sharply contracted the money supply by calling in old loans and refusing to extend new ones. A financial panic ensued, followed by a deep depression. Naturally, Biddle blamed Jackson for the crash, saying that it was caused by the withdrawal of federal funds from the bank. Unfortunately, his plan worked well. Wages and prices sagged. Unemployment soared along with business bankruptcies. The nation quickly went into an uproar. Newspaper editors blasted Jackson in editorials. The bank threatened to withhold payments, which then could be made directly to key politicians for their support. Within only months, Congress assembled in what was called the panic session. 6 months after he had withdrawn funds from the bank, Jackson was officially censured by a resolution which passed the Senate by a vote of 26 to 20. It was the first time a president had ever been censured by Congress. Jackson lashed out at the bank, "You are a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out, and by eternal God, I will rout you out." America's fate teetered on a knife edge. If Congress could muster enough votes to override Jackson's veto, the bank would be granted another 20-year monopoly or more over America's money. Time enough to consolidate its already great power. Then a miracle occurred. The governor of Pennsylvania came out supporting President Jackson and strongly criticized the bank. On top of that, Biddle had been caught boasting in public about the bank's plan to crash the economy. Suddenly, the tide shifted. In April of 1834, the House of Representatives voted 134 to 82 against rechartering the bank. This was followed up by an even more lopsided vote to establish a special committee to investigate whether the bank had caused the crash. When the investigating committee arrived at the bank's door in Philadelphia, armed with a subpoena to examine the books, Biddle refused to give them up. Nor would he allow inspection of correspondence with congressmen relating to their personal loans and advances he'd made to them. He also refused to testify before the committee back in Washington. On January 8, 1835, Jackson paid off the final installment on the national debt, which had been necessitated by allowing the banks to issue currency for government bonds rather than simply issuing treasury notes without such debt. He was the only president to ever pay off the debt. A few weeks later, on January 30th, 1835, an assassin by the name of Richard Lawrence tried to shoot President Jackson. But by the grace of God, both pistols misfired. Lawrence was later found not guilty by reason of insanity. After his release, he bragged to friends that powerful people in Europe had put him up to the task and promised to protect him if he were caught.
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will.
And this brings us to the ultimate question. Why? During the American Civil War, President Lincoln bypassed the high interest loans offered by the European banks and decided to do what the Founding Fathers advocated, which was to create an independent and inherently debt-free currency. It was called the greenback. Shortly after this measure was taken, an internal document circulated between private British and American banking interests stated, "Slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of laborers, while the European plan is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. It will not do to allow the greenback, as we cannot control that."
The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will.
Rothschild.
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 Rothschild. Rothschild.